Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Europe got the modern world going. Now, headlines read, "The End of Europe." No doubt there is trouble in the EU. It's sent markets on a wild ride in recent weeks. It's not over, and no one's sure yet how to stop it. Will Europe pull together or fall apart? This hour on Point, Europe in trouble and the potential spillover for the U.S. economy, the world economy. And we'll ask our panel about Europe's neighbor in turmoil, Libya, where rebels are now deep in the capital, Tripoli, just across the Mediterranean. You can join the conversation. Is Europe going over the edge? Is that possible? What kind of tsunami does that send here? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Voices from Europe. We have three Frenchmen here that spoke with NPR last week at a local fish market in Normandy on Friday. Here's one French citizen telling NPR about his frustration with his country's finances.
I will be retiring soon. I'm going to leave France. I'm going to live in a country without the euro.
Without the euro. And here's another French street vendor there telling NPR, using the same interpreter, that he still has faith in the European continent's single currency.
Oh, no, no, no.
Never. Never. I believe in the euro, and I think it's too late to leave it. What I don't like is every country in the eurozone has its own financial system. We need to change that.
And one more, Frenchman Paul Quelava in Normandy telling NPR the current crisis gripping Europe is due to a lack of experience coordination.
It's a new crisis, new type of crisis. I suppose we have no models, we have no experience. Each day we have to manage a new response to a new problem. It's my opinion. It's very, very difficult.
Making it up as they go, and the stakes incredibly high. Joining me now from Normandy, France, is Dominique Moisy, one of that country's leading foreign policy thinkers and author of The Geopolitics of Emotion. Dominique Moisy, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Welcome, Tom.
And joining us from Berlin in Germany is Nicholas Kulisch, Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. Nicholas Kulisch, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Dominique Moisy, first to you. As we speak at this moment, markets a little more settled today, and yet the sense that this is not nearly over. Where do you see this European crisis? Is it in some kind of control or still with an uncertain outcome?
No, it is still with an uncertain outcome. There is a lack of confidence which runs very deep and which is not linked to the conjecture but to structural problems. States are poor, the prospect of growth are low, and the prospect of unemployment are very high. So there is a sense of fear, pessimism, and I repeat, lack of confidence. Europe should be the solution, but Europe, for many of its citizens, is perceived as the problem, or at least part of the problem.
Europe as the problem. Nicholas, give us, if you'd be good enough, just the immediate mechanics of what the continent is facing in terms of the debt of member nations and potential solutions and solutions that remain out of reach.
Well, I mean, you have certain countries, I think we know the lineup, countries like Greece and Portugal that are having a really, really difficult time financing their debt. That's manageable, but if you add Italy to that group, then it starts to become questionable whether countries like Germany and France, aided by Holland and Finland and Austria, can really afford to actually bail them out. And so, you know, the real question is, you know, what's the will? What is the will here in Europe to rescue their fellow Europeans and with it their currency?
What's the will? What about what's the risk? I mean, Greece and Portugal already in quite apparent trouble. If that list should go on to include, in that kind of acute circumstance, Italy, Spain, Ireland, Even France has been under some renewed scrutiny lately. What's the risk for the continent here in fiscal, financial terms, Nicholas?
Well, I think, you know, in financial terms, the fear is that so much pressure, both from the markets and on the political side from citizens, that you could have something like, you know, the euro breaking apart, you could have default. I mean, you could have a real sort of financial disaster, although I don't think people understand exactly what that looks like. And so they're trying in a piecemeal way, and when I say they, I mostly mean Chancellor Angela Merkel and President Nicolas Sarkozy. You know, they're trying in a piecemeal way to just take each step they can to prevent things from getting worse, because no one, I think, really knows exactly what worse looks like.
Dominique Moisy will look at what might fix this problem, fix this situation. But if it's not fixed or not fixed in a timely way, what does the downside look like? If it goes to disaster, as Nicholas says, what might that look like?
Nobody knows, and nobody wants to know. To some extent, strong elements within the market are predicting the end of the euro, and they are not convinced by what politicians are saying, which appears to them to come as too little and too late. For a very long time, I would have said that the survival of the euro was about politics and not the economy. But today, I'm wondering whether politicians are strong enough, willing enough. Each of them wants to be reelected. Each of them has a strong and difficult electoral calendar in front of him or her. And are they willing to, in a way, risk their reelection for the sake of Europe and for the sake of the global economy? I'm not sure.
We'll look at what that would mean. But what about this, the end of the euro? If that should come in practical terms, in political terms, what would that mean, Dominique Moisy?
Well, in political terms, to a large extent, it would be the end of the European unification project. It would be a terrible blow for Europe and for its prospect of remaining a key actor in the world. It would mean, in fact, the deepening of the marginalization process of Europe. The world would have become multipolar, but there would be no Europe as a pole in that new world.
Nicholas Kulisch, that given, you know, where the world has been in the last how many centuries now, practically millennium, that's kind of a wild thing to imagine. Is Dominique Moisy an outlier in looking at this current circumstance in terms that profound?
No, Tom. I mean, I think that Dominique is mostly right there. The only country at the moment that would possibly be of global significance would be Germany. And, you know, and Germany only has 81.5 million residents. And you stack that up against a Brazil or an India or a China or even an Indonesia. And that's really not so many people. And every year, you know, they slip farther down the sort of largest economies in the world. And so it's really only together that Europe is a significant presence and a significant voice. And that's part of why they did this.
So loss of influence could be very dramatic. You're both saying here. But yet, if that should come, it would have that in itself would have an influence on the world. If, let's say, the more of these countries, if some, the countries go into default or the euro falls apart, what about the spillover for the United States, for the world economy, Nicholas?
Well, I mean, what you've seen over this summer, over the past few weeks, is that when there's concerns on one side of the Atlantic, they do spill over to the other side. So when the debt ceiling debate gets out of control in the United States, the European markets fall. When people feel that Merkel and Sarkozy haven't come up with a solution for the European debt crisis, then the American markets fall. So it's very clear that you can't wall yourself off from this phenomenon. And so I think, you know, everyone has an interest. And that's why President Obama calls Chancellor Merkel when things seem to be getting out of control and says, don't forget your duty. And he means duty to maintaining world financial stability.
Dominique Mosier, I saw an incredible headline last week. At this point, given how deeply, how much concern there is about European banks, how far their stocks have fallen, the American technology company Apple, is now worth as much as the top 32 Eurozone banks. What will it mean for the U.S. economy, for the world economy, if Europe's sovereign debt and, with it, European banks tumble into deep trouble, Dominique?
Well, it would be a major blow to the world economy. And this is where you have the paradox. Europeans do not seem to have the will to face to their responsibilities, do not seem to be willing to fight against the process of marginalization, which I described. But at the same time, well, Europe, as an economic and financial actor, remains considerable. It's politically that it's going down the drain. And in a way, the question we have to ask is the following. Are we about to enter into a post-Western world, in a world where the West is no longer running the show? Is a long period of more than three centuries about to close in front of our eyes? And this is something that concerns directly the United States. I mean, Americans, the most enlightened of them, are speaking of a post-American world, meaning that the rest, China, India, and others, are maybe in the process of catching up with the United States. But should one speak more radically of a post-Western world?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Europe in trouble, the continent's financial peril and its potential spillover for the USA and the world economy. Dominique Mosier joins us from France today, author of The Geopolitics of Emotion, very prominent French commentator on international affairs. And with us from Berlin in Germany, Nicholas Kulisch, Berlin bureau chief for The New York Times, been there since 07, and joins us from Berlin today. Let's hear a little bit of leaders of two of these countries at a joint press conference last week with French President Sarkozy. German Chancellor Angela Merkel defended the idea of a new economic government for the Eurozone, but not Euro bonds, not all of them backing one another together.
I think our propositions are perfectly adapted to regaining market trust, step by step. I think this is the right method, and I don't think that issuing Eurobonds would be helpful today.
No Eurobonds, no thank you. That reiterated over the weekend by the German Chancellor. In the same summit, Nicolas Sarkozy proposed a new, and Merkel, they proposed a new European economic government of a sort that would coordinate financial and economic policies in the Eurozone. Here's President Sarkozy.
The first of these proposals consists in setting up true economic government within the Eurozone. This economic government will be made up of a council of heads of state and government. Will come together twice a year, more if necessary,
et plus, si nécessaire,
and will elect a stable president for 2.5 years.
French President Sarkozy talking integration there. Now, Nicholas Kulisch, we heard the German chancellor say, you know, this is perfect, this is adapted to regaining market trust, but she's come to be known as Frau Nein, Madam No, when it comes to Eurobonds that might do this altogether. First, on this question of regaining market trust, is there evidence that the steps that Europe is taking for greater economic integration on policymaking are bringing out that trust in the markets? There, that's a very fickle indicator, but nevertheless, that one for starts, Nicholas.
No, I mean, absolutely not. You know, they get together and they usually they'll come up with a new plan, such as the bailout fund. And then for a while, the markets will be calmed, and then they'll go back and they'll look at the fundamental sort of levels of indebtedness and levels of commitment to helping each other and say, this just isn't enough. And in the case of the past meeting between Chancellor Merkel and President Sarkozy, they felt like they got very little. Mrs. Merkel also said that day that we can't solve these problems in a big bang. Well, it's a big bang that the markets are waiting for.
How does European indebtedness compare to other regions, countries around the world? How does it compare to American indebtedness?
I think it's actually a little bit. If you take an average across the eurozone, you would find it's better than the United States as a percentage of their respective GDPs. But then there are individual countries that are more indebted. But I think Dominique might agree with this that the political question that people believe that Americans will repay American debt. But the question of whether Germans will repay Greek debt is what's up in the air. And so even though they could live with the fundamentals, they can't live with the fundamentals connected to the political uncertainty.
Well, explain for us then, Nicholas, and I'll come to you, Dominique, but why you're there in Berlin, in Germany. Why are Germans, given the stakes here, we're talking about maybe the end of the euro or maybe the end of the EU or, as Dominique Moisy has it, the post-Western world, with stakes like that, why have they been so reluctant to come in and bail this out?
Well, I think there are two reasons. The first is it's really not that long ago that we were talking about Germany as the sick man of Europe, a country where with entrenched structural unemployment that was never going to rebound. And they went on really pretty harsh reforms, raising retirement age, making it easier to fire people, stagnant wages for years and years. And people were in those days out on the streets in Germany. And so they really feel as though, hey, listen, we did this. Why can't you? We had this pain. Why can't you, repeat what we did? But then on the other hand, I think there's really a sense in Germany that they could be a larger Switzerland, that they could be successful with their BMWs and their Mercedes and their electromagnets, and that they could make their own way, whereas some of these other countries kind of couldn't. And so I think those two ideas are both underpinning this desire not to pay.
Dominique Moisy, do you think that at some point before everything implodes, and maybe there's another way here entirely, but will Germany come in? Will they come in with their considerable resources and save the day? Do they have the option of turning themselves into a big Switzerland, which I guess means rich and detached from politics around them, sitting where they do in Europe, Dominique?
Well, what is striking is the lack today of European ambition on the part of the new Germany. There was a strong European ambition when the leaders of Germany had memories of World War II. Today, it's so far away. They were burned by history, so to speak. And when they are asked, what is the country you are dreaming about? 73% of Germans regularly come with Switzerland. Their dream is to become prosperous, stable, in some ways neutral, and by the end of the day, largely irrelevant. That is a problem that goes much beyond Germany, because Germany remains the good pupil and the strongest economic in Europe.
And they dream of kind of being off in their own, literally, Switzerland, perhaps. Dominique Moisy.
Geneva on the Rhine.
Yeah, Geneva on the Rhine. Dominique, please stand by. Nicholas Kulish in Berlin. I want to bring in an Italian voice. Joining us from Crema in Italy is Beppe Severnini, Italian journalist, author, columnist, author of the forthcoming Mamma Mia, Berlusconi's Italy Explained for Posterity and Friends Abroad. That's a challenge. He was a longtime correspondent from Italy for The Economist magazine. Beppe, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom, and hello, Professor Moisy, and hello, Nicholas.
We've been hearing from Nicholas Kulish and particularly from Dominique Moisy about the severity of this threat to all of Europe, the threat to the euro, to the EU, the European Union, maybe even to the West. Do the risks look that high to you, watching all this from Italy, Beppe Severnini?
Well, I've been listening to you carefully. I think I agree with most of what I heard. Italy is a little different. You have to remember that Italy, Nicholas wrote a piece in the New York Times in mid-August called Germany's Flying Above the Economic Storm in Europe. And Italy is instead is rider. We are riders in the storm. To quote the Doors, you remember?
Yes.
So, give us an emergency, and the Italian virtues come out. I'm not saying that what is happening is serious, but we are in a strange position that we are basically remote controlled from Europe, from Frankfurt, from the central bank, from Europe on the whole, from Brussels, and we feel somehow. Given the alternative, we feel not happy, but it's not a bad situation. And micro-control from below, because Italy, in terms of town halls and how people and the family and the network of family, you don't understand that it's a bargain economy that it becomes really important when the times are hard in dire straits. So Italy is sort of remote control from Europe and micro control from below. In the middle, of course, we have a government and we have Mr. Berlusconi. So consider our situation. Mr. Berlusconi yesterday was told off by the Italian president Napolitano, who told bluntly, and it's very unusual by an Italian president, that Mr. Berlusconi basically has tried to hide this crisis. I remember him telling us that the crisis was only psychological. And we don't, even his own voters, we don't really trust them anymore to manage the economy. The last two big budget, one in July and one in August, were done. A lot of money, 40 and 50 billion euros, because Europe told us to do so.
What's the risk of Italy going the way of Greece? What's the risk of Italian default, Beppe?
Well, I'm not that pessimistic. As you know, we own quite a lot of our own debts, but it is true that the explanation that my prime minister gave, like Italy is solid because families are not in debt and because they have a lot of savings, is not an explanation, unless he's trying to tell us that he's going to tax us to death in order to get to find the money to reassure the people who don't trust us in terms of paying back our debt. I don't think we shouldn't. I think in Europe we had it so good for so long that everybody, Nicholas, who is now living in Europe, and Professor Moisi, and everybody, and me, and a lot of European commentators, we had it so good for so long that we get really nervous very quickly. But I think all together, if we can fix a couple of things, the European way of life, I don't think we really want to give it up. I took a long train journey from Moscow to Lisbon in May, and I was struck. I've been in every single country many times, but doing it on a train journey, how life has become similar from Krakow to Lisbon, at least. It will take some time to dismantle all that. I know that I'm probably too optimistic, and as a journalist I should be more cynical. But somehow I think Europe still has a lot to say in the world.
Dominic Moisi, first to you, the European way of life, which is close to the European standard of living, maybe not exactly the same thing, but do you see that as invulnerable? Does that go on here, or does it hit a wall?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, in a way, it's part of the problem. The Europeans feel, somewhat rightly, that their model of life, their way of life, is superior, and they want to defend the status quo at all cost, even if they no longer have the means to do it. But I would answer to Pepe that I hope he will be right. But can you remain a model if you are no longer an actor in the world? This is a major question. And it's easier maybe in a country like Italy, where the state has always played a less important role than in countries like France or Germany.
Easier there, all right. But Nicholas Kulish, what about this sense that Europe will muddle through? What about that as an option, Nicholas, now?
Well, I mean, I think that's very much what Chancellor Merkel would like to see. And she, we hear in comments here in Berlin that she finds the sort of the hyperactive leadership style of President Sarkozy to be frustrating, because what she would like is for everyone to stay calm, let the markets pick up the calm from them, and slowly kind of put the screws to other countries, to make the indebted countries reform themselves, become more competitive. And so that's her belief, that we can get there, that if Germany did it, Portugal can do do it. The problem is that we've been trying this now for a couple of years, and it just keeps getting more expensive to finance our debts.
What about, instead of blowing apart, coming closer together, having more central power, even more central banking power, adopting something closer to the American model of United States, Nicholas?
I mean, we've definitely seen incremental steps taken that I think probably if somebody had been asked 3 years ago, you know, if the European Central Bank would do some of what it's been doing, or if the Germans would go this far toward the French ideas of economic governance, I think people would have said no way. And so I think there is a little bit of convergence, and maybe there is a glimmer of hope the way that Beppe is saying. But on the other hand, you know, the markets have a way of creating their own reality. If they make it that much more expensive to borrow, it becomes that much more expensive to pay off, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And that's happening right now. Let's go to our listeners. Omaha, Nebraska, Rob is calling. Hi, Rob. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm going to make a quick comment. I'm not an economist, but it seems to me that when the euro came to fruition, it was pretty clear that some economies were far stronger than other economies. But everything was going well with the world. So basically, you're valuing the euro on economies like Germany and economies like Greece when they're not the same. So now that there's trouble and some of the economies are strong and some of them aren't, everybody wants to leave. And that would be sort of analogous to, say, New York State saying, well, our dollar is stronger here and Louisiana's economy is bad, but we're not going to pay for Louisiana to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like to hear some comments on that, because it really doesn't make – it's sort of the law of the conservation of matter. So, I mean, it really doesn't make much sense, and I'll listen to your comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Dominique Moisy, what about the euro, the pressures on it? Is it guaranteed to stick around?
Well, this is, again, a clear political problem which rests on the issue of identity. I mean, you may say that the American society is more divided than ever, that Americans are not willing to make sacrifices for the good of their country, that they are hampered by ideology. But by the end of the day, there is an American federal system. There is an American sense of American identity. Is there a sense of a European identity? The Germans are not willing to pay for the mistakes of the Greeks. The French are not willing to make sacrifices for the lightness of the Portuguese or the Irish. So this is the problem. By the end of the day, when confronted with a major issue, are people reacting as Europeans, or simply do they say, well, but I'm not European, I'm a French, I'm a European, I'm a German, mm-hmm. I'm an Italian. This is the key issue. The debt problem may be more serious in America than in Europe, but America exists, and the question is whether Europe exists.
Beppe, we've just got half a minute before the break. Do you see Europeans breaking back into their constituent countries? I'm not a European, I'm an Italian, I'm a German, I'm a Frenchman, period.
I'm afraid that is definitely a problem. And if you look, we just heard President Sarkozy and Chancellor Merkel, but Europe is not ancient Rome where you had two consuls speaking for everybody else. And many of these sort of declaration and summits and proposals come from a couple of countries, two most of the time, with London looking at us. And this is not the way to be. I think it's unless we try to strengthen the political arm, I think Professor Moisy is right, and we're going to have a problem. People will react as nationals or whatever country.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Europe in trouble. You've seen it in the markets in recent weeks. Our panel today says the problems are not solved. And we will look at the fiery unfolding situation in Libya in just a moment here. We've been joined today by Dominic Moisy, top international relations specialist in France, author of The Geopolitics of Emotion. From Crema, Italy, we're joined by Beppe Severnini, author of the forthcoming Mamma Mia. And from Berlin, Nicholas Kulisch is with us, Berlin bureau chief for The New York Times. 800-423-8255 is our number. Let's go to Phil calling from Barrington, Rhode Island. Phil, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question was, it seemed to me when, like, I'm just finished college and everything, and I learned a lot about the EU expanding and bringing in lots of member states, but now that they're having so much trouble, is it possible that the EU could contract almost like a sports league that's overextended and finds itself in, you know, trouble, so they need to get rid of the weaker countries to keep a more unified Europe, kind of like maybe Germany and France, example, combining their powers and getting rid of Italy, Greece, and all the other debt-ridden countries.
Yeah, it would be a big swath of Europe that would go, but let's pick it up. Dominic Moisy, what about it? A contraction of Europe, of the EU, as a solution to this crisis?
No, I don't think it makes sense. I think, in fact, it is used very often as an argument by those who are saying Europe is bad today, because it expanded too much and too early. But Greece has been part of Europe for decades, and Greece has been the weakest link in the past few months. So this is not the issue. The issue is not to contract. The issue is to have the political will to face to one's responsibility as Europeans.
Dominic, online we have a lot of comments here, many interesting ones, but there's a thread running through our listeners' comments online saying, you know, when you talk about the end of Europe, the end of the Euro, the EU, the post-Western world, sounds like hyperbole to them, Dominic, that it's over the top, goes too far.
Well, I don't think so. You have to face the reality of the rise of China, of the rise of India, of the situation of economic growth and hope. I remind listeners to the book I've written on the geopolitics of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
The emotion of the Western world is largely one of fear, when the emotion of the emerging countries is largely one of hope, and it makes a big difference. No, I think we are faced to the possibility of a radical shift in the history of the world, with the torch of history moving from the West to Asia.
Big shift. Giacomo, Haddam, Connecticut. Giacomo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I was born in Italy, and I actually grew up there, and I spent half of my life before I came to the United States. And I have to say that I completely agree with the French gentleman. I do believe that Europe has lost its importance and is not relevant anymore since many years ago. If you look at the most important crises that have been, like the Balkans, for example, they were resolved by President Clinton sending American troops, Iraq, Afghanistan, even Libya. Libya was started by the French, the issue of, you know, freedom in Libya, but eventually it was resolved by the United States, because without the United States, there was no way that Europeans could pull through. So unless there is no identity as Europeans in the different countries, there is no spirit to sacrifice. And unless that changes, I do agree with the French gentleman a bit, Europe will continue to lose relevancy.
Giacomo, I appreciate your call. Beppe, let me bring it to you in Italy. You know, Giacomo looks out at history, recent history, and says Europe's influence is already gone. Now, that's interesting, because today we see the rebels, who Europe has very explicitly supported, apparently. We'll see what happens, but it appears as though they're on the verge of really taking over in Libya. Is that a victory for Europe alongside the Libyans there, Beppe?
Look, I think we're bringing in a lot of different things, at least three. Giacomo is right that Libya is a good example of a war that Italy could not avoid taking part in. Mr. Berlusconi was a good friend of Mr. Gaddafi. We had a lot of deals with Libya. So, and that happened in Libya, partly in Afghanistan, and elsewhere. It's a strange to take part in a war because you cannot avoid to do so. But that's one thing, and the fact that Europe is has had a problem with foreign policy and military intervention, we know it's been happening for a couple of decades now. But I may disagree with the word fear that Professor Moisy used. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at younger Europeans, what I call the Erasmus generation, they feel a little big bond together. If you see them together, and we're talking about millions of people in their 20s now, they move around Europe, they feel they have so much in common. Give them, if we give them enough time to become, sort of grow up and do something probably better than we have managed to put together, I'm an optimist. The real problem is money and spending and the fact that European governments, the Italian probably, a succession of Italian governments, most of all, but not only in Italy, of course, spending too much money because it was an easy way to be in politics. You spend, you make people happy, and you don't care, and you leave everything for the next generation. If we fix this, and that's a really big if, I agree, the rest will come. I don't think that Europe, fear is the common denominator of Europe now. If you look around, if you travel in the summer, if you see young people, you see they think, you know, they have a lot in common, a young Portuguese, a young French, a young Italian, a young German. Mm. We are a different generation. We tend to see the fear and the worries. But we did tremendous things. Bringing together Eastern Europe, for instance, that's another subject we tackled, was a bold move. Probably was a right bold move. I'm not sure that the euro maybe was a right bold move. Maybe it was too early for that.
Nicholas Kulish, what about the next generation? Maybe Germans are thinking, well, let's model. Europe's not as weak an idea as some might think. If we can just get along a little further here, this will somehow come together again.
Yeah, I think there's really, you know, two sides to this coin. On the one hand, you see the far right kind of populist, narrow-minded parties, you know, such as the True Finns or the Danish People's Parties that have gotten so much attention since the tragic events in Oslo, and they really represent this idea of Europe pulling apart. But on the other hand, you do have what we sometimes call the easy jet. Generation, the people who fly around on low-cost airlines, who have long-distance relationships between Barcelona and Berlin, or the people who I've interviewed who come here for a night to go to a club and then fly back to Italy. And that really is a reality. The question, though, I think, I mean, I agree with Beppe, but the question is, are they ready or are they willing to fight for it? And when the Danes announced that they were partially reinstituting border controls, I thought that was a moment when the people in their 20s would stand up and say, no way. And they didn't. They just weren't there.
What about what we're seeing in Libya right now as we speak? Could that emerge as a kind of reaffirmation of Europe? Europe's been very active in supporting the rebels there against Gaddafi. Is there apparent emerging success here, something that might kickstart a reaffirmation of Europe, Nicholas?
You know, unfortunately, I think that Libya actually stands more as an example of a European failure. I mean, it's a great illustration of Germany's, you know, my own private Switzerland moment, where they refused to join in. They wanted no part of Libya. And although we're seeing successes today, I'm not sure that anyone really think that when the West, when NATO began bombing Colonel Gaddafi's tanks, that it would take this long. And we still, as Giacomo said, you know, we still have troops in Kosovo, we still have troops in Afghanistan, we still have troops in Iraq. You know, the West is stretched very, very thin and is not holding together.
Dominique Moisy, this turn of events in Libya has indeed taken a while, but could it serve as a reaffirmation of Europe that you say has been drifting away?
Not as a reaffirmation of Europe, but as a reaffirmation of what political will can achieve when it exists. From that standpoint, what is happening today is a clear success for those like Nicolas Sarkozy in France or David Cameron in Great Britain, who have supported the rebels, who have refused to accept the bloodshed to take place in Benghazi. But it is also an illustration, as Nicholas said, of the deep division that exists within Europe. This was not the moment of glory of German diplomacy. One day we saw the German voting together with the Chinese, the Russians, and the Indians in the Security Council of the United Nations. To the dismay reaction of France, Great Britain, and other European countries.
Let's go to Stavros in Rock Island, Illinois. Stavros, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
And I just want to mention, I'm a first-generation Greek, and we used to sit at our tables back in the old days before there was a unification.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, my uncles, my dad, and our family would have these heated discussions, as often Europeans or Greeks can do. And the animated discussion revolved around the idea philosophically, and I agree with your panel's earlier remarks, that when you rob people of their individuality and their identity, it takes away responsibility. And my uncle, who is no longer with us, he said, I predict the day when there will be a huge bankruptcy, and very possibly the southern tier of European countries will be the ones who will break the union.
But Stavros, let me ask, I mean, Europe came together for a reason. One was to try to put to bed the old bad days of big war in Europe and that nationalism. Another was to make an entity so large that it would continue to be consequential on the world stage. Both of those are a lot to sacrifice, aren't they, if indeed that's what's on the line here?
A very good question, Tom. But then I ask you this. What about the French farmers who are protesting and the common people who would realize that there would be an economic deficit on their behalf? In other words, I'm speaking of the proletariat down there. What were they thinking?
Yeah, when it all came together. Let me hold that one for just a moment, Stavros. Thanks for your call. Northampton, Massachusetts. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question for the panelists. I'd like to know what they think about the idea that what we're actually witnessing is a crisis in capitalism and the end to Western capitalism and imperialism.
Let me ask you, before I take that to them, crisis in capitalism, but look at China. I know the Communist Party's in charge, but they're doing a lot of buying and selling and pretty capitalist stuff out of China. Does it look like the end of capitalism there?
Well, they do things their own way, don't they? I mean, it's not the Western monopoly capitalism that we're seeing right now here.
All right. Well, there's plenty of monopolies in China and the government in on some, but let's pick it up. Dominique, first to you. The end of capitalism, of Western capitalism?
No. The end of Western supremacy over the world, yes. The end of capitalism, no. As you said, capitalism is triumphant in China and in most emerging countries. No, it's not the crisis of capitalism. It is a crisis of... what is interesting is that what is at stake today is the legitimacy of power in democratic societies. Are they successful in facing the crisis? Are they successful in maintaining social inequalities to acceptable levels? And the answer is, for the moment, clearly not.
But Europe was supposed to be the great shining beacon of trying to do that with its social welfare systems, which were for a time the envy of many around the world, Dominique.
Yes, but we don't have the money to pay for it, and it's crumbling, except maybe in Nordic Europe, where population are smaller, where the state is more modest and more honest, where the gap between the very rich and the very poor is more limited, where the gap between women and men is also less deep. But if you say to other Europeans, the model is Nordic Europe, they would look at you and say, oh, but you have to be Protestant, you have to be small, you have to come from a very cold country in order to adjust to a model, to that model. Ask the Italians to pay their taxes like the Swedes do, or ask the French, or I don't think they would accept that. To not to pay tax is nearly a national pastime in countries like Greece, or for that matter, Italy.
Beppe, I'll bring that to you. Beppe, Nicholas Kulish, our time is short, but when will we know whether we've got a crisis continuing to rumble down the hill here, or there may be a muddle through answer, Nicholas? Is there a point at which it becomes clear, or do we just have to deal with a time of uncertainty?
Yes, I think we're absolutely stuck with a time of uncertainty. It becomes clear, I guess, when we manage to go a few months with any of these, without any of these stomach lurching drops in the stock markets, without, you know, widening spreads in the bond market, when the investors are reassured that if I loan this money to Italy, if I loan this money to Greece, I'll get it back.
Beppe Sevenini, does the future of Europe depend on Italians becoming Nordic? Living crisply and paying their taxes crisply?
Look, I say this on the radio that I pay taxes just like a Swede because
right.
I have no other option. Believe
right.
me, because my publishers and my TV and newspaper, blah, blah, blah. But
yes
things will, times are tough, but I think we only tackle the gambling that has become in the stock market. You mentioned before Apple, the fact that it's, mm-hmm. that it's worth more like 32 banks in Italy, that they are insurance company, huge as Generali, which is worth on the market less than its real estate, a bank that is worth less than its collection of art.
So?
This is too much.
So,
just a final point.
Yeah.
Go to into Italian or French or Spanish hospital if you come from Northern Africa and you understand that Europe exists.
You're happy to be there. You're happy for the care. Good luck to it. Beppe Severnini joining us from Crema, Italy, author of the forthcoming Mamma Mia. Thanks, Beppe.
Bye-bye.
Nicholas Kulish with the New York Times in Berlin. Thank you. And Dominique Moisy, author of The Geopolitics of Emotion. Thank you to you both very much. Dominique, Nicholas, thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.